Thank you very much, Nancy. Hopefully you all have got a single page, well, double-sided with handouts. Now, as I prepared this paper, I was really led into a mesmerising array of primary evidence and secondary commentary, anthropological, archaeological, historical, literary and religious. And I realised that I could make a presentation that would last, as early Irish sagas say, for 3 days and three nights, which could cover so much ground that my audience would end up in a state of undeserved mental exhaustion. But rather than subject you to an early Irish ordeal, I intend concentrating on a few texts and archaeological phenomena to the situation in Ireland, do with ritual, between, and again, I couldn't come up with a precise date. I kept vacillating between 300 and 400 AD and 700 and 800 AD, so somewhere in that period. And to frame them within theoretical and comparative approaches to the subject of conversion. Now, in her surveys of ritual, ritualisation and ritualists, the late Professor Catherine Bell made many observations, this is my Franciscan bit coming in, observance, which can be related directly to the Irish evidence. And yet, despite ranging throughout the world, through prehistory and history to the modern period, Ireland is never mentioned. And this is not exceptional. And indeed, I think one of the objectives of an international project such as the Converting the Isles project is to bring the Irish evidence into a more international dialogue. Be that as it may, in her book Ritual, Perspectives and Dimensions, which she published in Oxford 1997, Bell offered a neat classification of rituals and ritualisation. She did not claim to be innovative in her approach, but merely synchronised the many views of scholars on the subject. Nevertheless, her classification is a useful reminder of the types of rituals that are known universally and from which Ireland does not diverge. And these are handout number one. Rites of passage, so in other words, birth, male and female initiation, marriage and death, calendrical rites, rites associated with the solar and lunar calendar, and hence seasonal celebrations of sowing and reaping, commemorative rites, so for example the commemoration of historical events as in the life of Christ or the life of a saint, rites of exchange and communion, in other words making offerings, giving gifts to the divine in the hope of intervention, and hence various levels which Barbara York was speaking about, levels of devotion, ritual sacrifice to placate deities, communion, in other words, some form of sacrifice which unites the human and the divine. Rites of affliction, the need to rectify a disturbed or disorderly cosmos by acts of cleansing, healing, and purification, and hence acts of penance, pilgrimage, and forms of prayer. Rites of feasting, fasting and festivals, and finally political rites. Now all these rituals are very familiar and there are many examples of each which could be labelled as a pagan or a Christian version of the same fundamental rite. My concern today is how communities in Ireland between the 4th or 5th and 7th or 8th centuries coped with the rituals of two belief systems, and how the religious and political elites, indeed elites which at this time were often indistinguishable from each other, as again in so many similar societies, how they either enthusiastically received and promoted the new religion or remained steadfast in its loyalty or in their loyalty to existing beliefs. Now, I am cautious in describing either the old or the new as monolithic institutions which adhere to agreed practices throughout the island of Ireland. We do not know how practices varied with the old religion, and even though Christianity by then was based on a number of fundamental convictions and had developed certain universal rituals, especially, as Barbara mentioned, baptism, local conditions influence the conduct and physical manifestation of these rituals. What also affects ritual, ritualization, and ritualists in a society subject to change from one religion to another are what Martin Carver calls in his book, edited by him, The Cross Goes North, Trajectories of Conversion. And here on number two on your handout, I take from a paper on ruined stones and the conversion of Sweden, Dr. Lynn Lager's adaptation of Berkeley's phases in the conversion of Norway, which Barbara also mentioned, to the conversion of Sweden. So there are various versions of this. Infiltration: a population comes into contact with Christianity passively through trade and other contacts. Mission: the appearance and spread of missionary activity. And institution: the establishment of an ecclesiastical institution and the building of churches. Lager correctly expands on Berkeley's phases by pointing out that several different phases could have occurred at the same time in different parts of a country or a territory, and also the opposite. In other words, you could have a setback in the process of conversion. In other words, a total reversion to an older system. Carver further adds a stage of adaptation, and I quote, where Christianity is being mapped on the pre-existing social structure, and I would add, on a pre-existing landscape. If these phases can be applied with various regional nuances to Scandinavia and elsewhere, can we adapt them to Ireland, and in particular to the rituals of two belief systems in existence between 400 and 700 AD? How can we advance our understanding from a theoretical or vague appreciation of what was happening to a more practical representation of the religious beliefs and rituals performed in Irish society at the time? Now, you may not be excited if I also start with Patrick's letters, the Confessio and Epistola. They are so often the starting point of such discussions. However, I am not going to deal with the dates of his mission to Ireland, where he was active, or his relations with those whispering signores who caused him such headaches. I will examine some of his references to rituals within the framework of Catherine Bell's summation of genre of rituals and of the revised version of Berkeley's Trajectories of Conversion. While Patrick's writings will be the centrepiece of my review, I will stray into other evidence, archaeological, historical, and literary, and hopefully find my way out with some reasonable conclusions. The main reason for starting with Patrick's letters, as Thomas has mentioned, is that here we have a person describing at first hand, as long as we believe the authenticity of the texts, the four phases of conversion: infiltration, mission, institution, and adaptation. Infiltration is understood from his own very coming to Ireland as a boy and the context that caused this event to occur. In other words, the Irish raiding the western coast of Britain, and his escape on a boat leaving Ireland, which either involved raiding or trading. Mission is everywhere in Patrick's texts. He is a zealous missionary. Institution is on his mind as he ordained clergy, as he says, for this people who have lately come to believe. Adaptation, the mapping of Christianity onto a pre-existing social structure, is everywhere in Patrick's narrative, and in particular in his choice to give gifts to kings and payments to their sons who travelled with him. The latter, the sons, being a sort of combination of forming Christian disciples and of having a retinue or a dov in common with other members of the nobility. And subsequently, as happened, how Christian bishops in Ireland and also abbots went around the countryside. But how does Patrick inform us of rituals and the ritualists, both Christian and others? Patrick himself is clear in his creed, so staunchly declared at the beginning of the Confessio, and I only have a very brief piece on number three from the Confessio. This is because there is no other God, nor will ever there be, nor was there ever, except God the Father. He is the one who was not begotten, the one without a beginning, the one from whom all beginnings come, the one who holds all things in being. This is our teaching. Here we have one particular missionary who is a believer in one God without beginning, a God made man through his Son who conquered death, a judge of all and the Trinity. And as with so many societies, most of these basic precepts of Christianity would not necessarily have been very difficult to accept. The difference was cultural, namely the conduit of information was ultimately through a new language, Latin in Ireland, new texts, for example the Bible, a new mode of communication perhaps, mass literacy as it happens, and also a new sense of history in that we were talking about a historical person in Christ. Names were different, and the emphasis on a single overarching God was more emphatic. But how did you become part of this movement? The Christian ritual most prominent in Patrick's letters is the ritual of baptism and confirmation, which actually went together. And here I take from the Confessio and the Epistola, number 4 in your handout. Therefore, it is very right that we should cast our nets, so that a great multitude and crowd will be taken for God. Also, there should be clerics to baptize and encourage a people in need and want. And from the Epistola, the newly baptized and anointed were dressed in white robes. The anointing was still to be seen clearly on their foreheads when they were cruelly slain and sacrificed by the sword of the ones I referred to above. Baptism and confirmation are rites of passage, birth or rebirth, and initiation into the church. By performing this new rite of passage, was Patrick replacing existing rites, or did the two ritual systems continue to exist in parallel? Where did Patrick perform his apparent mass baptisms, and what imprint did these events have on the landscape? By receiving a Christian baptism, Patrick's neophytes were given a new identity, which in the 5th century would have probably set them outside their own society to a certain extent. Indeed, Patrick says so. And here we have handout number 5 from the Confessio. There was a blessed Irish woman of noble birth, a most beautiful adult to whom I baptized. She came to us a few days later for this reason. She told us that she had received a word from a messenger of God who advised her that she should become a virgin of Christ and that she should come close to God. And thus she became a virgin of Christ, as others had. Their fathers don't like this, of course. These women suffer persecution and false accusations from their parents, and yet their number grows. We do not know the number of our people who are born there. In addition, there are the widows and the celibates. Of all these, those held in slavery work hardest. They bear even terror and threats, but the Lord gives grace to so many of the women who serve him. Even when it is forbidden, they bravely follow his example. Patrick had introduced a public ritual, as Barbara had mentions this idea of public ritual, which had social consequences. Depriving a noble father of a potential bride price or good economic or political alliance by attracting his daughter into a religious way of life, which may have been hitherto unknown. Or by effectively breaking the bonds of a female slave, a woman without status so necessary in a household or on a farm, or even in begetting children for their master. So little wonder, for example, that this theme reoccurs so forcefully in the early lives of Brigid, where her mother's status as a slave to the king and his reluctance to part with her as she, although a Christian, was carrying his child, form the core of Brigid's early life. In terms of anthropology and cognitive science, as expounded by Eliade and in recent dialogues by Pascal Boyer, Harvey Whitehouse and others, and bravely in an Irish context by the Finnish scholars in the University of Helsinki, Patrick's public ritual forms would have involved memorable pageantry, water, chrism, white clothes, which must have appealed to the senses and would have been more exciting than habitual rituals. His success, and that of other missionaries, therefore, was rooted in conducting new ritual forms sufficiently memorable and frequent to lead to their transmission into the existing culture. Patrick baptized adults and by giving them a new identity created a community within a community. The rite of baptism consisted of various elements: exorcism, instruction, fasting, anointing with chrism, submersion or immersion in water, and taking of communion. The neophytes emerged from the rite, as Patrick mentions in the epistle, wearing white clothes. Dr. Niamh Whitfield, in her recent study of Holy Wells in early Ireland, makes a very cogent argument that wells were used instead of baptistries in Ireland, and henceforth the proliferation of holy wells. The physical possibility of using wells for baptism was made feasible by the fact that submission or immersion was rare in late antiquity, although not out of the question, and that effusion, water being poured over the head, was more widespread. If Patrick and other missionaries and their successors appropriated wells for their Christian rite of passage, did this not signify an encroachment into a sacred space already associated with rituals? Healing and sacred springs are no surprise, nor are wells associated with particular animals. All are well known from Britain and are often linked to healing and fertility. And you see it in the names of wells in Ireland. The well of Sherrish, the source of the Boyne, which is overlooked by Carberry Hill, County Kildare, is the location of a cemetery which included Iron Age cremations and later inhumations dating between the 5th and the 7th centuries. One male inhumation from the circular enclosure of Site B at Carberry Hill was accompanied by an iron shears, which must have had some significance. And a radiocarbon date of 471 to 643 AD was obtained for this burial. My colleague, Dr. Elizabeth O'Brien, has suggested that Site B might be an ancestral grave marking a boundary or this type of ferthe. Carberry Hill is Sidh Nechtan, the home of a deity consort of Boyne, the river goddess of the Boyne. The well of Sherrish is associated with magical hazelnuts that appear to induce imbos, poetic or prophetic inspiration. And I quote the section from the 8th century Cauldron of Poesy, translated by Professor Liam Brannock, to show you how this is in the literature as well, early Irish literature, all these connections between imbos, the well of Sherrish, and water, and indeed hazelnuts, as you will see. As for human joy, it has four divisions: the force of sexual longing and the joy of safety and freedom from care, plenty of food and clothing, until one begins bardhna, which is a form of poetry, and joy at the prerogatives of poetry after studying it well, and the joy at the arrival of imbos, which the nine hazels of fine masted Sherrish in the sheaths amass, and which is sent upstream along the surface of the Boyne, as extensive as a wether's fleece, swifter than a racehorse, in the middle of June, every 7th year regularly. And this is from what seems to be an 8th century text. Whoever ate the nuts or drank the well's water or the salmon which consumed the nuts gained a power of imbos, inspiration or divination or supernatural knowledge, as indeed Finn MacCool did, or, according to another text, as Cormac MacCuillenon, the King Bishop of Cashel, who died in 908 and reputed author of Cormac's Glossary, did. And if you doubt that Patrick or any other missionary had to compete with such ritual activities at wells, I would draw your attention to a recent rescue excavation at a place called Inchegreenog, Barony of Shannon, County Limerick, described in summary as following by the excavator. So hence we've gone from Patrick to our literature to seeing if it actually happened. She says, Kate Taylor says, the site was on the western edge of a low-lying bog at the base of a steep hill. To the east, the area was bounded by a stream and several springs were encountered during excavation. The site was characterised by two fallach the fia, which seemed to be sort of cooking, earlier barbecues or whatever, we don't know, with wood-lined troughs, a spring with a deposit of a human skull, several layers of peat containing numerous wooden artefacts, and a post-medieval stone trackway. In the edge of the spring, in a thin deposit of peat above the burnt stone, was the human skull, apparently deliberately deposited. The skull was overlain by a layer of unburned stones, which capped the spring and gave the impression of a platform. A further layer of peat covered the entire site, rich in wood with plentiful preserved branches, twigs and seeds, particularly hazelnuts. At the upper, as with the upper peat, large numbers of worked wood pieces and animal bones were recovered. And I understand through Betty O'Brien from the excavator that she reckons, they haven't dated it yet, that we're talking from Bronze Age to post-medieval here. And it is precisely such a scene that Tíochán in the 7th century depicts when Patrick comes to the Well of Slán in Finnvach to baptise Mani and to found three churches. And here I have handout number 7, briefly. There he found a square-shaped well covered with a square stone. And the infidels, the incredulous, said that some wise man, a propheta, that's a poet, or somebody perhaps imbued by imbus, had made for himself a shrine in the water under a stone to bleach his bones perpetually because he feared burning by fire, and they worshipped the well as a god. Needless to say, Patrick countered their belief that there were bones under the capstone and claimed that gold and silver from the wicked sacrifices of the Druids had leaked into a well. Now, apart from the obvious reference to votive offerings at the well, which I think Sarah will discuss in detail, and also the likely possibility that human bones were concealed in the well, it is notable that both this well, the Well of Slán, and the Well of Shinne were in the territory of a people known as the Curca Tevne, or the Tevenrige, as was the church of Kiltoch in Regione Tevenrige I Geru Contra Solis, in the territory of the Tevenrige in Kerra in the west, which may be the barony of Cara, County Mayo. Now, my colleague in the place names commissioner, place names branch in Dublin, Donal MacGill Aspig, has made the very important observation that the name stem, Tewin, may be cognate with Greek temenos, in other words, this root tem, to cut, with an N suffix, and that the Curca Tevne, or the Tevenrige, may have been the people of the sanctuary, in other words, the guardians of these wells. And therefore, the Curca Tevne bring me to the subject of the order and role of ritualists. Patrick was a ritualist himself, undertaking fundamental rites such as baptism, confirmation, communion and ordination. As a bishop, he clearly belonged to a hierarchical institution and was in some way answerable to a higher authority. He also hoped, through ordination of clergy, to establish that institution in Ireland. As a member of a ritual order himself, he recognised the role of such institutions in society. They created, organised and performed significant rites in the community. And so he says, and we have handout number 9 from the Confessio, "You know yourselves how much I expended on those who were judges in those regions which I most frequently visited. I estimate that I gave out no less than the price of 15 persons so that you might benefit from me and that I might benefit from you in God." Who are these people? Why did he visit them? Why did he pay them? I suggest that we approach these questions in a manner somehow different from previous discussions of Druids. Rather than regard the ritualists of pre-Christian Ireland as a disparate group easily assimilated into the Christian sacerdotal order, can we not view them as a parallel order of ritualists, as we have in so many societies throughout the world? In Patrick's Confessio and Epistola, we find aspects comparable, for example, with the Roman priesthood, the whole idea of the magisterial, the judicial side, and, of course, which is ultimately the Christian priesthood, among the native ritual order. In other words, what is sometimes called the Neva, those who controlled rituals such as a rite of passage, perhaps the very Curca Tevne that we're talking about. And on one hand, we have an acceptable aspect, the legal aspect of their work. And on the other side, an unacceptable side, the magic or prophetic aspect, which Patrick condemns, as in handout number 10 from the Epistola. "And so you will reign with apostles and prophets and martyrs. Left outside are are dogs and sorcerers, or poisoners, and murderers, with the lying perjurers. Their lot is in the pool of eternal fire." And these acceptable and unacceptable facets of native ritualists persisted in early Irish law, literature and society. The power of incantations are regarded as particularly evil and constantly censured in religious or Christian texts. For example, Cormac's glossary associates the Drí with Archetel and Brechta or incantations. And in her magnificent study of the 8th century Old Irish Lorica, Fiadha, the Deer's Cry, Jacqueline Borsch demonstrates how evil is warded off by surrounding a list of evils with words of divine protection and calling on the Trinity, God and Jesus Christ, to protect the supplicant. And the list of evils is instructive, and it's number 11 on the handout. Today I interpose all these powers between myself and every harsh, pitiless power which may come against my body and my soul, against the incantations of false prophets, against the black laws of paganism, against the crooked laws of heretics, against the encirclement of idolatry, against the spells of women and smiths and druids, against every knowledge which harms one's body and soul. And Borsche concludes very perceptively that being confronted with evil may cause feelings of despair and lead to passivity and depression. Coping mechanisms help one to fight these feelings. The belief in power, words of power, was probably such a source of support for medieval Irish people when faced with evil, which is exactly the issue raised by Barbara York about what do you say when you're in trouble. And lest anyone think that Irish society had fully reached the final trajectory of the conversion process adaptation by the 8th century and that the spells of women, smiths and druids carried no weight by then, I refer you to the following analytic references and also to Professor Kim McCone's discussions on Coynes and Mac Bosch and so on. But if we look at 738, Cernach son of Fogartach of the Síolne the Slán in the East Midlands, is treacherously killed by his own criminal adherents, and the calves of the cows and the women of the lower world for long bewailed him. Hence, the bad ones, because he was bad. The following year, Fergus Gloth, king of Cuiv, which I take to be in the northeastern part of Ireland, died from the venomous spittles of wicked people. And even poor Flann, Bishop Flann, abbot of Inishcoin Deira, was killed by poison in 786, and I had hoped, I looked to every possible property of hazelnuts, hoping that they would be poisonous or something, but they're not. They're all to do with love and so on. If people such as the Kirk of Tevna or the Tevenriga controlled access to sacred places and created and organised rituals around them, can we deduce from Tirachon's depiction of their territory that there were certain landscapes set aside already for religious purposes, that this did not come with Christianity? The Kirk of Tevna seemed to have controlled two sacred wells, and one of their sites was converted into a church, Cell Todh, and one of their people became a bishop. In his 7th century life of Patrick, Murrichu also implies that Mam Reach in the East Midlands was such a landscape, to quote him, because it is there that there was the greatest kingdom among these tribes, the head of all paganism and idolatry. And if one views the archaeological record as any sort of guide to such a statement, it is not an exaggerated claim. For in Malmrech, or in Brega, you have Tara, Paltu, the Boyne Valley tombs, Fornox, and many other important sites. Nonetheless, in the same area, in Brega, it is this region that we find the coexistence of cultures and beliefs. For example, in Cope, in the barony of Duleek, Lower County Meath, is a complex site which overlooks the River Boyne estuary and is well known from the literature as Inverculte. 120 burials were discovered, buried there within a circular enclosure, which in turn was located within a very large triple bank enclosure. At Culte, there is no evidence as of yet for a church or other structure there. And anyway, there is a great difficulty in identifying actual church structures in this early period. But what was found was imported pottery associated with Mediterranean vessels, B&E ware, and imported glass was found in the larger outer enclosure. So Cope was probably an emporium or trading post on the east coast of Ireland. Whoever controlled this place was economically and consequently very powerful. And clearly this type of place was open to outside cultural influences, including Christianity. which would fall between the... And we have burials, again, falling between the 6th and 7th centuries AD. But what about the intriguing burial of 161? This burial was inserted into a pit dug into the outer edge of the perennial enclosure and consisted of a disarticulated male burial placed within animal bones in a wooden chest or box with iron corner brackets. A bone sample from the skeleton produced a 5th or 6th century date. This was clearly a special box burial of an individual whose bones had been collected and placed in the wooden box. Box burials are otherwise unknown in Ireland and relatively rare in late antique Britain. So does the box contain the reliquiae of a martyr or holy person from outside Ireland, or a local person who is venerated in some way in a late antique manner? So in the burial record at Cope, you find exactly what we are talking about from the literature. This coexistence of belief systems, these very complex patterns of belief. Now, I finally come to political rights, and again, one could talk about these forever, and particularly to kingship. Political rights which display and construct power or the sanctity of power are not explicitly described by Patrick. Yet the institution at the heart of political rights, kingship, is an important consideration in his mission, and indeed continued to occupy the church, a parallel institution, well into the medieval period. Patrick's exhortation at the end of the Confessio reminds us that he was introducing a feast involving a mystical drink into Ireland, that of the Eucharistic meal and communion, and you have it there on number 13. In other words, to drink in his chalice. The ritual equivalent of Patrick's communion drink was to some extent the ale of kingship, so pervasive in early texts to do with kingship and sovereignty. The fesh or the feast, the bonish, the hieros gamos, and the tharavesh, the bull feast, are politico-religious rites that had to be ultimately controlled by the church if it was to direct kingship away from the trappings of an earlier belief system. I think that a dialogue about the adaptation of the rituals associated with kingship was intense and protracted in this period in Ireland. It went to the heart of the old belief system, the hieros gamos and the drink of sovereignty. And you find it almost literally a dialogue in very complex texts, such as Bulachin, such as Echtr Conle, The Adventure of Conle, such as Adolf Morand, The Testament of Morin, which is a Speculum Principum, and others. In other words, we are at the point of, very important point of adaptation, an adaptation of kingship, which is so core to society. And we have that dialogue in what are probably 7th century texts in Ireland. For after all, you are moving kingship from the king and the goddess to the king and his client and another overarching god, and probably directed by another priesthood, a Christian priesthood. And hence, finally, the author, probably a religious of the Cauldron of Poetry, who in the view of Liam Brannock was by now comfortable in providing what Liam says, a comprehensive model to supersede the conflicting views of the native learned classes and of the ecclesiastics. This author could open with lines that the source of all talent and inspiration was the Christian God, which you find in number 14. This author was part of the official reflective belief system upheld by secular and ecclesiastical institutions. The evils denounced as the spells of women and smiths and druids of the lower world were the intuitive forms of religion, what sometimes is called popular religion or that other level of religion, which diverged from the official and must have lingered on for centuries. For as argued by the anthropologist Pascal Boyer, in spite of efforts by religious specialists to define what is theologically correct for their people, there always seems to be some non-standard beliefs and practices left sticking out. And that was particularly true for early Ireland. Thank you.